Dennis McKenna grew up in Paonia in the 1950s and 60s with his brother Terrence at the corner of 4th and Orchard. Terrence became a counterculture pioneer, writing about psychoactive drugs, human evolution, shamanism, aliens, and the nature of consciousness. He died in 2000 at the age of 53, victim of a brain tumor. Both brothers were early and avid readers. Science fiction, the natural world, all topics they pursued. Dennis received his master's degree in botany at the University of Hawaii in 1979 and his doctorate in botanical sciences in 1984 from the University of British Columbia. As a scientist, his focus has been on the therapeutic uses of psychoactive medicines derived from nature and used in indigenous ethnomedical practices. He joined the faculty of the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota in 2001. He's also worked for AVITA and as a research scientist at the British Columbia Institute of Technology near Vancouver. In 2012, Dennis wrote a memoir about his life with Terrence titled The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss. He funded it through Kickstarter. Dennis McKenna, welcome to KVNF.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I love the photograph on the cover of your book. Could you describe that for people who haven't seen that?
Yes. Everyone seems to be charmed by that photograph, including myself. It was taken at the Black Canyon of the Gunnison, which everyone in Paonia will know, and it was 1957. My mother took that picture with her little Brownie camera, and it was just one of those things out of the family album, and when I saw it, I knew that that had to be the cover. A lot of people seem to agree. It really kind of says all there is to say. You know, my brother was the visionary gazing off into space, and I was the scientist focusing in on something, and it's always been that way. So,
and he is standing behind you. The binoculars are around his neck, but you are looking through them.
But I am looking through them, that's right.
Yeah, it's very, very charming, and it's... I don't know. It's a metaphor, right?
It is. It is indeed. Yeah. You know, it well complements the book, the illustration on the inside, which is a line drawing, a charcoal drawing, I believe, done by a friend of ours about 1998 when we were together at a conference at Asilomar. So we're that much older, but the pose is kind of similar. I like the way those two pictures play off of each other.
Tell us about your home at 4th and Orchard across from the Paonia Town Park and about the family that was around you growing up as a kid.
Well, it was 703 4th Street, yeah, so it was much smaller when we lived there. And it was one of the first kind of, 50-style split-level home. It wasn't really split-level, but I guess ranch-style. Yeah. And I think it's interesting. My mom grew up on the same block. That house is down, but if you just go down Orchard about halfway, I don't know what's there now, but there used to be a very modest wooden house there, and that was where my mom grew up and her sisters and brothers and all that. So she never moved far from home, you know, except when she and my dad were out in Oakland, California during the war, and that's, you know, so she got her bit of urban experience and all that, but then came back. And when my dad got out of military, he was headed to California. He had a job waiting for him, I think in the insurance company or insurance industry. They stopped by in Paonia to say hello to my grandfather, my mom's father, his wife, who I never knew, had passed away shortly before just decided to stay.
And your life would have been very different had they made that decision.
It would have been very different. But, you know, in retrospect, I'm very glad they didn't. I mean, at the time when I was a teenager, I thought, why did you, you know, get me stuck in this podunk town, you know, and how I could have grown up in the Bay Area or someplace like that, and it would have been more exciting, you know. But time lends a certain perspective, and you know, 40 years later, I've come to appreciate what a special place Paonia is. You know, teenagers don't really have the wisdom to understand when they've got it good. They're, you know, discontent is part of the mindset when you're 16 or 17. But, you know, when I look back on it, I think we were really lucky to grow up in Paonia. It was a special place, and it is a special place.
And it sounds like you had a pretty close circle of family life with your cousins and aunts and uncles and your grandfather for a while. And
yes, we did. We had you know, my mother's younger sister, Aunt Maine, was, you know, they were very close. They were close in age, and they were, you know, they supported each other very much. And Maine's children, the twins, as we call them, were identical twins. They still live in, well, Judy still lives in Paonia, and Jody has lived there for many years. She kind of lives some of the time now in Arizona. She recently remarried. But, you know, that was really the framework of our family. And then, of course, later, all the cousins and, you know, their children and great grandchildren and all that. So I actually have quite a brood of relatives in Paonia on my mother's side, mostly on my mother's side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always a pleasure to go back there. And I've recently reconnected with some old friends, you know, from high school. Writing the book has you know, renewed those connections. So that's really been gratifying as well.
And you went to the Catholic Church right down the block from
me. Went to the Catholic Church, yes.
And was that a community that also was, did you feel close to anybody there, or was it less so?
Well, it was less so. I mean, I was pretty devout. You know, I was what my wife calls a good Dogon. I was an altar boy. I was pretty much involved in church related activities up until the time I sort of, you know, began to question all that. And the way the parish was organized, the priests would come and go, and there'd be visiting priests over the summers and that kind of thing. And
mm-hmm.
Some of those were pretty smart Jesuits, and I used to enjoy hanging out with them and talking about philosophy and the really, you know, big questions. And they didn't convince me that their view was the right one, but we had some very good conversations, and they force you to think, you know, so that was good.
Your education is really interesting to me. So you went to Paonia Elementary and Paonia Junior High and
mm-hmm.
Paonia High School, and you had some supplementary, like the science magazine that your father subscribed to, and
uh-huh.
So there was some reading material coming in. There was the occasional Jesuit priest.
Uh-huh.
But it seems that by your way, your early teens, you had a pretty sophisticated philosophical framework that you were dealing with. And I'm amazed at some of the writing and some of the thoughts you were grappling with. Of course, a lot of it was Terence, huh? Feeding you stuff.
Yeah, a lot of it was Terence's influence, you know, because he was 4 years ahead, and he was really discontented with Paonia to the point where he pushed so hard to get out. before he finished high school, he basically drove my mom and dad crazy about it, and they just finally said, okay, already you can go to California, which he did in his junior year, and ended up living with my aunt and uncle, my aunt Tress, in Menlo Park. They were school teachers in Menlo Park, but they came to the Crystal River Valley just across McClure's Pass every summer because they ran a dude ranch there in the summers. So Terry went out to California as a junior and lived with them for that year, and then he ended up living with someone else, another family in Lancaster, because my aunt and uncle got tired of his shenanigans. So so he was out on the West Coast on the cutting edge of everything that was happening at the time. And it was like I was stuck in Paonia, but I was in regular touch with him, and he was kind of leading the charge. And, you know, he'd come back, you know, for Christmas and summer and bring all these funny ideas and stimulating books and radical notions and share them with me. I think in some ways, you know, after he left home was really the time that we got close to each other. I mean, before he left home, I was just a pest. And, you know, we had the usual sibling rivalries going. But then when we were actually not living together, we came to appreciate each other a lot more. And so, yeah, he was a very important influence on my thinking. But I think it was a mutual thing. I mean, I was always more inclined towards science and that sort of thing. You know, I was preoccupied with cosmology, so and astronomy and astrophysics. That's where I found where I visualized my career would go. You know, that those areas do make you think about the ultimate questions. And that was certainly front and center for both of us for a long time.
Mm. How did the natural world influence your life view?
Well, just the fact that we had access to the natural world. You know, my dad was a fisherman, a hunter. I mean, he was a woodsman in every way, and so he took every chance he could to get us out into the wild. And, you know, fortunately, around Paonia, you know, there was a lot, you know, a lot of it, and also our weekends at the ranch over with the Chairmont Ranch over in the Crystal River Valley. We had lots of chances just to range and roam through the forests and woods. And, you know, I used to do that even as a teenager. I used to do that. And especially, I mean, when I was, you know, during the summers when Terrence wasn't around, and after age 16 when I discovered cannabis, you know, I like nothing better than to just go on hikes and smoke a little weed and really appreciate the environment. And, you know, if you're familiar with the effects, you know, you can get very sort of focused in on details. And in that environment, the effects of cannabis are almost psychedelic in their own right. So that was the influence, just basically an appreciation for being outside. We weren't particularly focused on hunting or fishing. And we did those things because my dad did those things. But I just like going out into the wilderness and communing with nature, I guess that would be the term. Sometimes pharmacologically assisted and sometimes not.
And just watching the sky here, I mean, it's a pretty glorious sky view in this
mm-hmm.
area still.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Some dark skies.
Yeah. Yeah, I loved, and you know, when we were younger, going out to the Dobies with my mother, we'd just take a picnic lunch and go out there, because Dad wasn't around during the week, you know, so we didn't have much to do, and Mom liked going out and just, you know, having a picnic or just spending time outside. It was a different era. I mean, we took nature for granted, I suppose, at that time. Terry was, of course, even at that age, was into collecting butterflies and had a pretty good rock collection going and all that. So we had all these sort of interests and, I guess like not unlike a lot of young children or younger children this day, this era, I guess we were what they would call geeks or nerds, mm-hmm. you know, in the contemporary parlance. That's what we were. We were just curious kids with a bent toward science. And that was kind of what we were. As I wrote in the book, a lot of this was influenced by our mutual interest in science fiction, which, really predated all of that. I mean, we were reading science fiction in the late 50s, early 60s, and again, my dad, I think, was an unwitting sort of influence on this, because he would bring home things like Fate magazine sometimes, which is still published, by the way, and actually, the Fate magazine is based really close to where I live now, and they still put out interesting stuff, and you know, so he'd bring these things home. He'd bring other, like, pulp science fiction magazines home, like Analog or Fantasy and Science Fiction. These were, you know, these were just things that you could buy off the newsstand. I suppose it was escapist literature in a certain way, but it stretched our imagination.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing. It stretched our imagination and the idea of, you know, other dimensions and time travel and space travel and all this. I mean, we yearned for those things, and we probably consumed far too much science fiction, but it kept our imaginations alive. You know, the writers that influenced us when we were younger were Arthur C. Clarke, probably primarily Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, Heinlein, Theodore Sturgeon, Ray Bradbury, all the classic old guys of the old, and most of them were guys. I don't recall any women science fiction writers that we knew of at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of an old boys club, but these were the old school, and we read them all for sure. But Clark was a seminal influence. His imagination was so active, and that, you know, the worlds and the scenarios that he wrote about just seemed really quite stimulating and fascinating for us at the time. And then that, of course, you know, sort of culminated in 2001, the movie 2001, which really sort of addressed a lot of the ideas that we were fascinated by. And by that time, we had our psychedelic initiations, so that stimulated it even more, an idea of the evolution of consciousness, the evolution of the human species, and whatever the triggers might have been in 2001, it was, some alien influence. And in later years, I've argued that, the trigger was psychedelics, these psychedelic compounds and plants that are resident in nature that we may have accidentally discovered. And I think that gave us that gave human consciousness a boost in evolution. That's what I say. I don't have any proof for it, but it seems a reasonable idea, actually, to me.
Well, let's talk about your own evolution with psychedelics, and tell about your first time smoking cannabis.
Well, my first time smoking cannabis, I remember it actually pretty well, considering how far back it was. I remember it because it was the summer of 1966, so I was 15 years old, and Terry came back from California. He was in He just started at Berkeley at that time, and he came back with his new girlfriend and with, this terrible cannabis. I mean, it was really, nobody would bother with it these days, but that was what they had, and we'd been corresponding, and of course, everyone was excited about it. We were in the middle of the hippie movement, not in Paonia, but other places. So when it happened, I had just, less than a week before, at the 4th of July dance, I'd had my first encounter with another psychoactive drug, which was, in this case, blackberry brandy. I overconsumed it. I had no experience at all with it, and I made a real fool of myself in public. And I decided I didn't really care for alcohol. I didn't care for that state of mind, and I had plenty of reasons to be ashamed of the way I conducted myself. I mean, it wasn't that terrible. I suppose anybody who, goes out and gets drunk and behaves obnoxiously, we've all done that, I suppose, or at least as kids you do. But 5 days later, Terrence came with cannabis, and it was such a contrast. We went over to the city park just across the street and spread out a picnic blanket and broke out something to eat, and he took out a pipe, and we sat around and smoked all afternoon, and smoked and talked. That was the thing. It seemed to stimulate conversation and funny ideas, and it was just such a contrast. It was a calm kind of thing compared to the alcohol, which made me want to run around and insult girls and stuff like that at the dance. This was just sitting around and doing what we'd always done, which was sit around and talk about ideas. So it was, for me, it was a pleasant surprise. It was like, in fact, the first few times I thought, is this really doing anything? does it really work? It took three or four times for me to realize that, there's a subtle shift in thought and in your surroundings. You seem a little more attuned to your surroundings, but it wasn't really, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't really that big a deal. I mean, it wasn't then, and it isn't now. It's, far too much is made out of the dangers of cannabis, I think. I think it's pretty benign, frankly.
Well, we've legalized it here in Colorado now.
That's right. You've legalized it. Congratulations.
We can grow 6 plants. Ooh. Only 3 of them can be flowering at one time.
Uh-huh.
They have to be hidden or screened or something.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be discreet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. I don't want to see it really commercialized, extensively. I'd rather see it be used in exactly that way, something that people do in their gardens. It's not a commercial thing. It's not a corporate thing. I mean, given the opportunity, I'm sure the tobacco companies or even the alcohol companies would move in on that and try to commercialize it. And in a sense, I think it's better to leave it uncommercialized. If people are motivated to grow it, if they care about it that much, they should just be allowed to grow it if they want to share that with their neighbors and so on. In other words, do it, treat it more like, you treat vegetables in your garden rather than some commercial drug plant. And I guess that reflects my own, my own conservatism in a way. I feel like these plants are in some ways part of a legacy to our species, and we should respect them, and we should not abuse them, and we should not necessarily commercialize them.
That was part one of an interview with Dennis McKenna, brother of the late Terrence McKenna, former Paonian, now an ethnobotanist and author. For KVNF, I'm Marty Derlin.